The best.
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 Best. Best. Best. Of Cresta in the Afternoon Countdown. Number two.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. Last night, President Obama addressed the nation from the Oval Office on the San Bernardino terror attack and the war on ISIS. Join me right now to discuss the president's words and also some broader considerations is Catherine Gorka, president and co-founder of the Council on Global Security, former executive director of Westminster Institute. She and her husband, Sebastian, who's joined us on this program before, are co-founders of the Institute for Transitional Democracy and International Security. And good to have you with me, Catherine. Thanks.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
The president last night finally did actually say something that I had not noticed before. You may have heard him say it before. But he actually did mention that this is an ideological group within Islam. And is he finally coming to realize that this grows out of a certain type of soil, religious soil?
He actually used that phrase for the first time in February of this year.
Okay.
There was pressure on him from some of his advisors, but the problem is it's not translating into any kind of policy change. That's the real problem. It's like he's just paying lip service to it.
Yeah, okay. Well, I don't understand that, and we have lots of people talking about how so-and-so got radicalized and all those very interesting things. What the American people don't understand, though, is that there is a particular religio-political ideology at work out there. And ISIS is one major, probably the greatest manifestation of it at this moment. And that those who are practicing it are deeply rooted in Islam. And you can, you know, the Muslims themselves are going to decide the degree to which they're going to legitimate these particular movers and shakers. But this is clearly going on within Islam, and when we start asking how so-and-so got radicalized, doesn't that just psychologize the discussion and leaves us not engaging the ideas that are motivating these people?
Oh, you couldn't be more right, and it's a real problem. Looking for these psychological reasons why people engage in terrorism, this goes back to the late 60s and the early 70s, and it's really taken us nowhere. Nothing helpful has come out of that line of inquiry. And same with pursuing the sociological inquiry. And I think this is where Obama has gone so far astray, because I think he's been really persuaded that this is fundamentally a sociological problem. It has to do with upstream causes like lack of employment, lack of education, political disenfranchisement. But as you said, you know, none of those things are really true. The terrorists are, many of them, from middle class or even better backgrounds. They're well educated. But what is common to all of them is they are deeply rooted in this ideology.
You know, what is the relationship of this ideology to historic Islam? Is this line of thinking that's often traced back to people like Sayyid Qutb, is this a novelty in Islam, or is this rooted in historic Islam?
Actually, it's so great that you asked that question. I haven't heard anybody else ask this question, and I think it's exactly what we need to be talking about. It's got its roots really in parts of the Quran, but the real problem is what happened in the 13th century, ironically enough. A lot of this goes back to a 13th century Muslim scholar named Ibn Taymiyyah.
Mm-hmm.
And his name comes up. Osama bin Laden wrote about him. His name comes up in much of the jihadist literature. And it's sort of like, you know, he is to the Islamists what Thomas Aquinas is to Catholics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what happened when people of faith encountered reason, right?
Yeah.
We found a way to reconcile the two. In fact, reason was really embraced.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Ibn Taymiyyah did the exact opposite. And there were others around him, but he's the one that we really credit for this. And he said, reason is completely anathema to Islam. We can only go back to the roots of the faith in the Quran, in the Hadith. And that's a big part of why we are stuck where we are today, right, with this big rise of the Islamists.
Yeah, yeah. No, I agree. It seems this way to me too. And I don't know if this is why I keep saying it. Muslims themselves are going to have to deal with this. In the meantime, we've got to at least understand it and defend ourselves of it. What can be done to help the American people understand this? I realize that's a big question. Sometimes I feel like we've learned almost nothing since September 11, 2001. We still have the same cliches that are being passed about Islam as a religion of peace, or that somehow the American Muslims are under great jeopardy because we're all going to misunderstand them and terrorize them. But what can be done to help the American people grasp, just like we help people understand what communism was, what can we do to help them understand global jihadism?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, I mean, I think there are people out there who write about this very intelligently. I mean, the one who comes most to mind is Robert Riley, who wrote really the seminal book on this subject, The Closing of the Muslim Mind.
Great book. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, terrific, very important book. And I think the best thing that we can be doing is actually allowing the conversation, because so much of the message we're being given is that we're not even allowed to talk about this. You know, we're told that if we can't speak Arabic, then we can't possibly understand the Quran, and I think that's not true.
Mm-hmm.
And I think allowing the conversation, I think creating opportunities where Muslims as well can take part in this conversation. I think they're being shut out. Yeah. I happened to take part in a meeting in Rome back in December 2012 with some Muslim reformers, and they said they are completely shut out by the Western press. Nobody wants to hear from them, you know? And they've got very interesting things to say.
Sure, sure. Yeah, you would think so. With a world religion of this length and size, you would think there'd be some diversity of thought, some attempts to deal with problems there. We could hear. I have a Turkish journalist friend of mine who insists that Islam is compatible with free markets, free religious liberty and conversion. You know, he's out on a limb, I think. But the point is, he is one serious thinker. And there are others. But I'm not especially sanguine about it. But I can't. What bothers me most is that we don't have an intelligent conversation going on in the United States on this. And our leaders are afraid to do it. The president still won't really look at the religious dimension of this question and the ideological roots of this. When you look at the Republican presidential candidates, do you see anybody there that gets this problem?
I think probably the one who knows it the best is Rick Santorum. And
yeah,
I was thinking the other day he'd make a great Secretary of State. But I think Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio maybe get it.
Mm-hmm.
I think what's interesting is that people of faith, people who are Christians, probably understand it than people who aren't.
Yeah.
And that's another problem with this administration, is that atheists don't really understand how a religion can be such a motivating factor, so they dismiss it as irrational. But I also hold academia to blame, and I think it's really a problem that, like, the Saudis and others have pumped so much money into our universities on Middle East studies, because it's really sort of derailed free and open conversation about these topics. There are little pockets of interesting conversation. There's a little, I'm thinking like St. Anselm's up in New Hampshire is one where there's some interesting conversations going on. But we're all kind of trying to learn this from scratch, and the only way we're going to do it is if we're allowed to talk openly, if we're allowed to have conversation about it. And unfortunately, right now, that's really being shut down.
Mm. I mean, you know, Saudi Arabia, I think, provided a great deal of money to Georgetown to study this, and I'm just so disappointed that we can't seem to get from Esposito over there any serious warning about these kinds of things. I don't understand it, and I wonder if in fact it's because Georgetown has accepted so much money from the Saudis.
Oh yeah, I mean, you know, I'm right here across the river from Georgetown, so I go to a lot of their events and I see all the things they produce. And frankly, I just think it's shameful. I don't know how anybody has any respect for them anymore, yeah, given what a mouthpiece they've become, right, for the Islamists, for the Muslim Brotherhood. I mean, I personally, I don't see the free exchange of ideas going on there.
No, I agree. It's amazing. Just amazing, yeah, to me. What at this point, what can the president do? This is an ideological conflict, not purely a military conflict. So what do you think good prudent action would be on the part of the U.S.? How should our policy be changed?
Well, I think we've got to take the threat in the Middle East a lot more seriously, and airstrikes alone aren't the answer. Neither do I think we should be pouring thousands of U.S. troops, but I think that the big area for improvement is we could be playing a much more effective leadership role in getting other countries in the region for whom this is a concern to engage as,
yeah,
well. I mean, I feel that this administration has focused so much on countries like Iran, Turkey, and Qatar, none of whom I see as a,
right,
really sensible ally in this fight, and we've virtually ignored Jordan and Egypt, who,
yeah,
I think,
yeah,
would be very good allies,
yeah,
and whose military we've been training for years.
Yeah.
That's certainly one area. I think the other hugely neglected area is the whole ideological fight, the whole information operations. I mean, I know we've got little pockets of things going on here and there, but when you think about the fact that the State Department's Center for Counterterrorism Communications had at its height 15 people working on counter-messaging, whereas we've got 17,000 people sitting over in the Defense Intelligence Agency, I mean, it's just so skewed. You know, we're never going to be able to push back on ISIS messaging with 15 people sitting there tweeting,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah. No, I agree.
But it's interesting because I think it's being recognized. I mean, you're not seeing changes up at the senior level, but at sort of down below, more down on the ground, I think there's a lot bigger recognition of the importance of the information war.
Okay.
And I think people are kind of scrambling to figure out how to engage in it. And it is a difficult one, and it's going to have to be multifaceted, but we need to be doing it, and we can be doing it.
Catherine, thank you so much. We'll talk again. I really appreciate you joining us today.
Pleasure to be here.
Catherine Gorka is president and co-founder of the Council on Global Security. I'm Al Cresta. Be back in a minute.
The best.
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 Best. Of Cresta in the Afternoon Countdown.
Number two.